I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. In 1863, a small black church was founded on the banks of the Missouri River. 150 years later, Second Baptist Church survives with a modern-day mission rooted in its founding during the Civil War. This hour, we'll talk with the church's senior pastor, Reverend Dr. Vernon Howard, about the church's longevity, his own background, and the real challenges the church and its congregants face: poverty, schooling, violence, and unemployment in its urban core community. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Do the math. Subtract 150 years from 2013, and you wind up with 1863. That's the year Kansas City's Second Baptist Church became a reality, making it one of the two oldest black churches in the city. The country obviously was midway through the Civil War, and back in those days, Second Baptist Church was a mission known as a straggler's camp, located on the south bank of the Missouri River. Over the years, the church has been led by just eight pastors, meaning that the leaders of Second Baptist have enjoyed long tenures. These days, the church at 3620 East 39th is reaching out to deal with crime and a high unemployment rate, and it's about to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's March on Washington. Joining us now is the current leader of Second Baptist Church. That's the Reverend Dr. Vernon Howard. Again, he's the church's eighth pastor. And Reverend, so nice to have you. Welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you for having us, Steve. Appreciate it.
150 years. What kind of achievement is that in your view?
I think it's unparalleled.
Yeah.
I think it is filled with the divine hand of God, obviously.
Yeah.
There is a kind of unbelievability, if you will, because of that kind of tenure. And I think it stems from just the zeal and the passion of the people who have made up the body and have witnessed to Christ through this church.
You know, one thing that strikes me is that you talk about 150 years, and that seems pretty amazing by itself. But then, as I said in the opening, you do the math and you go back to the fact that your church began midway through the Civil War, and that sort of gives it a different kind of connotation, I think.
I think it gives us a sense of the faith and the courage of those who were led by Reverend Clark Moore, who was the founding pastor, and who was aided by some others who, in the middle of the state of Missouri, mm-hmm. which was one of the states that refused to come on board with the North. And so it was a rather hostile environment and politically risky to take a chance to be African Americans and emerge to even start a church and be public in the witness like that.
I'm guessing that over the years you've had the church has had some serious ups and downs. Can you recount one or two of those to us?
I think, like all churches, SBC has had its ups and downs. When I think about the history of the church, perhaps one of the most glaring was when a superstructure that was built under the leadership of Dr. Samuel Bako, was the pastor at that time, was actually burned to the ground. This superstructure, and we can locate that area right around 10th and Charlotte downtown.
You can still see it today.
There are places where you can get a sense of, if you've got some old pictures, where it stood at that time. But
right.
There was a superstructure that was built that attracted National Baptist Convention African-Americans from all over the country at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It was the place to go for black Baptist congregants for national fellowships, but was burned to the ground and was a serious setback because it was so significant and such an icon. There
why?
Is speculation that arson was involved, but never proven.
And the motive might have been what?
Well, it's hard to speculate.
Yeah.
If you think about the significance of black institutions within our liberation struggle and within the whole context of our development as a people, one could speculate that that was a part of it, but we just don't know.
Have there been other setbacks along the lines you just mentioned there?
I don't think that we have documented any on that level. Mm-hmm. I think most of them have been churches who strive to fulfill God's mission within oftentimes very hostile, very difficult times for the people that we minister to. One of the things that we were talking about in our meetings with faith-based leaders earlier in the week is that the church now is in a position where it is being asked to do things that the civil community or the government generally has done very effectively.
Social services you're talking
absolutely,
about.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Now it is the church that is beginning to have to step up and be involved in education, step up and be involved in job training, be involved in life skills, do the kinds of things that develop people, not just spiritually, but develop people with their careers, their vocations, their social life and so forth. And oftentimes called upon to do it without the resources of government or the civic society.
I was going to say, is that a fair expectation? And what kind of burden does it place on Second Baptist Church to have these newfangled, these new style responsibilities, in a sense?
I don't believe it's fair. And the reason is because if we are called upon by the civic society and government to say, help us, aid us with doing what you do best, then aid us, we say back to the civil society and the government with the resources in order to do it. We would love to have multiple resources to be able to erect and construct buildings that educate our young people and our children and do the kinds of things in terms of health initiatives and social services that are done by the larger community.
But that's not happening.
It's not happening to the extent that it should, but it is happening on some levels in our own church. For example, we have a social services ministry, and 100% of what we do to help people with utility bills, to help people with doctor bills, to help people with their rent and their mortgages, to help people with food vouchers, to help people with transportation on the metro to get back and forth to work or to school, yeah, comes from the pockets of the congregants, faithful members of SBC who are helping people every day. And so your point of it's not happening in terms of those resources to help us do that, mm-hmm, not to the extent that it could.
You're talking some really serious dollars that, as you describe those different responsibilities, that's a lot of money. That's adding up quickly in my head as you're ticking off those things. Am I right?
It can add up very quickly. And the need is always greater than the resource that we have to provide.
So how is your church handling that? I mean, handling that load, handling that extra responsibility. Is it a burden or is it something else as far as you're concerned?
We're handling it faithfully and prayerfully. And the call of God is always both a burden and a blessing. It is always both sweet and sour. Mm-hmm. The most difficult thing is to have to come to grips with the fact that you can't always do all that you know needs to be done in situations. And the blessing is when you are able to see, for example, I won't call a name, but I'll say just a pseudonym, Serena, who just recently joined our church within the last 2 years, 25 years old, 3 children under the age of 8. Did not graduate from high school for various reasons that I do not know about. comes to the church having legal problems and difficulties, made some bad decisions, and wound up in some legal trouble. Because of the limitations in education, does not have the kinds of opportunities and viable options that someone else might have. Mm-hmm. This is a person that comes in dire straits and obviously has limitations in terms of employment. We do some things to help her, number one, stabilize her legal situation, which means actually having disciple makers and congregants surround her and help her and counsel her to navigate through those legal problems. And in some cases, help to actually handle some of those legal problems if we can. Mm-hmm. Also do some things to help with stabilizing the home environment for the children with some food vouchers, because if we don't do that, children will go to school without having the kinds of nutrition that they need and won't be able to perform well. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are other needs in terms of setting her up with other existing agencies such as Urban League and Full Employment Council and others who can help her try to navigate through that malaise of jobs that are out there that oftentimes don't provide enough income to mm-hmm. help her to move into a situation where she doesn't need aid. And so that brings up the issue of developing her job skills and developing her academically. It's complex, but we try to do the best that we can. This is a person who has come out of the legal troubles, faithful in church now, guiding her children who have been baptized now at the church and going in the right direction. And we believe that she is one of the success stories that we have.
So you're seeing a difference.
We're seeing a difference. Just a couple of days ago, I won't name again, pseudoname. Let's call him John, who had some legal problems, was involved in some criminal activity and developed a felony record, but then decided that he was going to turn his life around and make a change. He went and got some training, developed himself, received a certificate at a local junior college that enables him now to counsel people through other problems and difficulties he had in his own life. Very proud of that. Changed his lifestyle, has done some other things to turn in some of the other things that were symbolic of a negative lifestyle, and now he's on the right track. So we see great changes, we do.
Yeah, I can just begin to appreciate the need for all kinds of services within your own church. And again, how well set up is your church to handle these very, as you said, to use your word, complicated cases?
Organizational structure is important. Gifted and talented people are important. Most people believe that the African-American church is monolithic. Not so. There are multiple cultural layers in the African-American church, multiple economic layers. Not only are there persons who have struggled to navigate through our tough system in America, we also have attorneys. We also have a former City of Kansas City high-level managers and administrators. We have teachers, instructors, PhDs. We have persons with master's degrees, business owners. So it's a cultural milieu there on all levels. And these people bring their resources to bear. We have a great number of beautiful aged seniors. Most recently, a couple of weeks ago, we have what we call the 90-plus club. And we celebrated some 10 to 12 individuals within our congregation who are 90 plus years old. Mm. And of course, they bring wisdom and courage and a testimony to bear that helps us as well.
How many members do you have in Second Baptist Church these days, Dr. Howard?
On the church roster, there's about 600 members. There's anywhere from 300 to 400 who are very active in making contributions and serving the community through the ministries of the church.
Hey, how is Second Baptist Church? And again, if you're just joining us, we're visiting with the Reverend Dr. Vernon Howard, who's the pastor of the Second Baptist Church, the oldest, one of two of the oldest black churches in Kansas City. Just in general, as you look back over the arc of recent years, you arrived at Second Baptist just a few weeks, actually, before the Great Recession dug in and dug in hard. nationally. I'm wondering, how is your congregation weathering the storm in the wake of all of that economic calamity from 2008 and 2009?
The first 2 years, 08, 09, and 2010, we were blessed to see that the financial impact upon us was not immediate. It did not impact us like it did other churches that we knew about and other pastors that I would speak to. And so we were very blessed by that and were able to move forward and lay foundation for a future advance for the church. Most recently, we held a ceremonial groundbreaking for a new parking lot that we have plans to build in order to make sure that we fend for the needs of our seniors, our weak, our elders, and those who have less mobility in terms of moving around. So those first 3 years after 2008 were very fruitful and beneficial to us.
That surprises me.
It surprises me if we had not been blessed by such a faithful congregation already. We're talking about people who have been at the church for 40, 50, 60. In fact, in worship, I identified a couple of people who had literally been members of Second Baptist for 70 plus years.
Wow.
The kind of consistency in financial stewardship and service that these beautiful saints bring to the table is something that can hold you and sustain you in the midst of outer currents of financial instability. We are beginning to see, though, even more, some of the impact of the recession that you were mentioning. And one of the things that we deal with, Steve, frankly, is that the average income of a person that might join SBC on 39th and Monroe, as opposed to the average income of someone that might join a church in Leawood or Lee Summit or anywhere else in the suburbs, is far less, so that the financial windfall, if you will, of a new member may not be as much as others. But we've also learned that God is able to take the little that you have and do much with it. And we've discovered if we are faithful with what we have, God will provide.
What's an example of that?
I think one of the things that we dealt with is what we are moving forward with in the future right now as we look at the plans that we have to actually expand ministries. And one of the things we see is that if we're going to move forward with meeting more needs and expanding our services, we have to upgrade technology. We have to upgrade facilities. We have to upgrade equipment. We have to be able to, frankly, provide the kinds of needs that other churches in other places who have more resources will be able to do very effectively. So what we have done, Steve, is made sure that we put in place an apparatus, a system where people know this is the way that we're going to give and contribute to what God has called us to do. And we have the Miracle on 39th Street stewardship campaign where we see people continuing to come and give and make sure that we build for the future of the church.
You know, I know one of the concerns that the church faces, obviously, and you talk about it on your website. I've heard you talk about it with our producer, Stephen Steigman, before today's broadcast. This whole notion of what your church is doing about the violence that so much plagues the inner city. How bad is the problem? How is your church responding to that?
It is annihilating for so many lives.
What a great word. What a great
it
word.
It is. It is. Yeah. It literally is. I've done in 5 years more funerals than I care to say of parents, siblings who are broken by the violence. And it is annihilating. And it is a complex problem, but a comprehensible problem.
Meaning,
when a child is brought home to a home from the hospital and does not have proper health care to keep him or her healthy. When in that home, there is not solid parenting from mother and father that is guiding that child in their own personal development. Yeah. If there is not some kind of faith foundation that gives that child spiritual grounding that keeps him or her ethically and morally directed, and if there is a failed education system that does not help to develop that child academically so that he or she can compete in the world and in the labor market. Yeah. If there is then in that same environment, Steve, only liquor stores and pawn shops rather than new erected buildings and community centers and recreation centers and libraries, then you pour in that same environment guns and drugs and economic divestment, not investment, but divestment. Mm-hmm. You wind up with a recipe for social disaster, social oppression, and depression. And people and have no place to turn. That's what we're seeing. So when I say that it's complex, it is. But it's comprehensible. We understand what's going on. We're not hoodwinked. Now the issue is what we do about it, and it's a large task. And I failed to mention, Steve, then on the backside of all of that, you erect more prisons in order to house our young men and our young women in. It becomes a vicious cycle, a matrix of oppression.
You know, there have been attempts to sort of, many attempts, obviously, to sort of begin to deal with this very complex problem that you're describing, Dr. Howard. And one of those attempts involved L. Brooks and the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime and sort of trying to come up with solutions and strategies and all of these things. Where does that stand? I mean, where do those efforts stand? Because you hear about these things from time to time. They sort of make the news paper, then they sort of fade away, and then today you and I are sitting here having this conversation, which has been repeated so many times over the years.
We hosted and held a citywide peace summit about 3 years ago. Mr. Brooks was present.
Yeah.
The study that he commissioned when he was mayor pro tem earlier, before we had the summit, was reviewed, and recommendations that were given were displayed, and there was conversation and dialogue about putting these kinds of initiatives in place. One of the things that we've learned is that there are many efforts aimed at battling against poverty and crime and unemployment and so forth. What we learned is that we've got many people who are doing good things in different places across the city and across agencies.
Of course.
But there is not this kind of citywide, comprehensive, martial collaboration, if you will, among people.
What stops that from happening?
I think people have their own resource streams for battling the problem. I think people have their own networks and people they're comfortable with for battling the
problem.
People
are operating in their own little universes.
Absolutely.
And they're not sharing. They're not coming together to sort of combine resources to the extent that you'd like to see.
Not to the extent that we are talking about. And mm-hmm. So work is being done, but not that kind of large-scale martial work that could be done if there was a collaboration. We're hoping that, and we'll talk about this in a little bit as you guide us, this August 28th event that we're going to have, that we're hosting.
To commemorate the March on Washington.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. But I would like to say a couple of things have happened two or three times in my tenure at SBC. We collaborated with two neighborhood associations recently to galvanize ourselves against the issuing of liquor licenses to two different businesses that wanted to start up and sell liquor in the urban core. One was at 43rd in Indiana, and one was another well-established chain at Linwood and Prospect, which I mm-hmm. shall not name.
Mm-hmm.
Two areas that are riddled with crime, unemployment, and poverty, and we just did not feel that another liquor license was part of the answer.
And you were successful.
And we were successful along with our city representatives who represented us well, kept us informed of what was going on, neighborhood groups who were concerned and vocal, and of course the church and clergy who came around and said, this will not be good for our community. We need to stop this. And on multiple occasions, we've done this. This does not solve the problem, but at least it stops more liquor and more things that do not aid and help us socially, financially, economically in our community.
So sometimes small steps are important.
Sometimes it's very important to have victories like that. The one liquor store license was right next to Martin Luther King Jr. Elementary School, which is about 4 to 6 blocks from us. So sometimes we have some positive things that happen.
Well, Doctor, let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here. Let's talk about how you avoid getting discouraged. Let's talk about what else needs to be done. Let's talk about the school district. Let's talk about your commemoration of the March on Washington coming up, okay? Again, our guest today, Reverend Dr. Vernon Howard. He heads the Second Baptist Church. It's one of the two oldest black churches in Kansas City. We're talking about the plight of that church, sort of where it is today, getting it on the map for all of us. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Well, this hour, we're visiting with the Reverend Dr. Vernon Howard. He's with the Second Baptist Church in Kansas City. That's our town's second oldest, one of two oldest black churches in the city. We're talking about a whole array of issues that confront the church these days. You know, Reverend, when you talk about all these problems, you know, school district, crime, liquor stores, and the lack of job training, lack of jobs, all of these kinds of things. As a pastor of a flock your size, how do you avoid getting discouraged? How do you keep up? How do you deal with sort of the onrushing series of problems that you're confronted with each day?
We serve from the inside out.
Mm-hmm.
There is a drive, a determination that I can only say comes from God for me personally. It is a commitment to make a change, to be a difference maker in the lives of people that we meet. It is something that you have to stay in tune with so that the outer currents don't sweep you away in the discouragement
that you talk
about. It can absolutely happen. If one is not careful, one can be overwhelmed by the cynicism, by the hopelessness, by the despair of persons that you are actually placed to be a shining light and hope to. And so there's an inner resource that comes from God that keeps you going. I also believe this. I don't believe that any of us are placed in situations or circumstances because we are akin or mirror the situation. I believe, as I've looked at great leaders and individuals throughout history, that they've always been put in situations and circumstances that challenge them to make a change in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
If you were not intended to change the environment, then you wouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that gives one drive just to know that. So staying spiritually grounded, keeping yourself in an inner circle of persons who are encouraging, who know you, who you can trust.
Other pastors.
Who are loyal to you. Other pastors, mm-hmm. family, staff. Ministerial teams, yes, all of this is important.
You know, I bet you're going to avoid this next question answering it. I'm going to ask it anyway. How many days a week do you work? How many hours a week do you work?
I work 7 days a week and 24 hours in those 7 days.
You didn't avoid that at all, did you? Yeah.
Not at all.
That's literally what happens.
Not at all. Not at all.
The phone rings in the middle of the night.
Let me just say that you are always to be available, and that's just the nature.
How often does your phone ring between midnight and 6 a.m.?
Of the work. I wouldn't say how often it does. But what I actually have to do is to make sure that I take time for myself during the week and on a regular basis, which is a very difficult thing to do, but must be done.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit ago about violence and how the church is responding to that. I noticed that your church went so far as to create an official sanctuary, and that's an official legal term, I believe, for urban youth and those involved in urban gangs. What was this official sanctuary program, and how have you used it, Reverend?
Not legal.
Okay, it's not legal. It's not like the sanctuary
not
movement
legal.
For immigrants from Central America. Okay, different
thing. Nothing of that nature.
Okay.
But through those individuals that we have within the church, whom some of them have actually left that lifestyle and have become members of the church, some even have answered a call to preach the gospel and to become clergy persons themselves. Some of them are members who serve, and we are able to work through them with their connections that they have to persons who may still be shackled, who may still be tied up in that lifestyle.
Yeah.
And they know through not a real public kind of way that there is an avenue for them to come through. Hey, there is somebody, young brother, who has been where you are, and he's right here at SBC.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't advertise that. We don't go to great lengths to put that out there, because that's not always the best thing. But we do come to grips with that kind of need for these young men and young women to know that.
You know, you were so articulate in describing the environment that helps breed crime in the first half of our show today.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to see happen? Let's move outside your church for a moment. How does the city needs to respond? How does the community needs to respond to exactly what you're up against? What needs to happen? 1, 2, 3.
When I met a young brother, and I should say got reacquainted with him, who had joined our church a couple years ago, just the other day, I said to him, I was at a place getting some lunch. I said to him, "Where have you been? What's going on? We want to help." He said, "Dr. Howard, I need a job. I need a job. If I had a job, I could pay bills. I could live by myself and be independent.
Mm-hmm.
There are things that I could do to continue to try and advance myself educationally. But I need a job." This is one of the most basic kinds of provisions that a civil society and a just society must work harder in order to expand and broaden the base of opportunity. I think we all know that this kind of information age, technological age, and the kind of globalization of our markets and our economy have left a whole slew of underground individuals who have not been able to access the economic opportunities in our country.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them exist in the urban cores and urban centers of metropolitan areas, and that's what we're dealing with. We need to raise the level of the minimum wage to help working poor people be able to better fend for themselves and their children. And we need to broaden the base of opportunity for jobs for those who do not have those kinds of skills to enter the workplace right now. We need to do it in such a way that it does not hurt and harm and bring any kind of danger to our market system that right now helps to create those jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to have a balance. We've got to broaden the base. If we don't, none of us will be safe. If we don't broaden the base of opportunity for the least of God's children, then the safety of all of God's children is at risk.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here if you want to join our conversation with the Reverend Dr. Vernon Howard of the Second Baptist Church of Kansas City. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or tweet us @kcurupdate. And so on your last point, what do we do? There's been talk about jobs and jobs programs and retraining, and Governor Nixon's here every other week talking about these kinds of programs. What's not happening to help your people? What needs to happen?
I think it is a matter of a commitment from those who are providing jobs and who have the means and the capacity to do it.
Business owners.
Yes, absolutely. Business owners. But not solely, simply business owners, but multi-global, multinational corporations, perhaps, mm-hmm. who are very heavy at the top in terms of profits and earnings. There is room to spare in terms of profits of many of our companies and corporations that can more evenly distribute opportunities on the bottom level of the system. Yes.
But these days, you can't even get grocery stores in your neighborhoods. So how do you, if you can't get that, how are you going to get the rest of it?
A commitment on their part, a collaboration with them and with churches like ourselves.
Are you talking to agencies?
We are trying. One of the things that happens is that when we have dialogue and conversations about this thing, there's always the fear that broadening the base may do some kind of harm to the well-being and the economic status and standard of the company and corporation itself. We've got to find ways to get beyond that fear. The other thing that we do, and this is very critical and important, I think, as well, is if we don't begin to teach and train through the education system, and I'm talking about the public education system now, which is the majority system where many of our young people are taught and are trained, then it doesn't matter what kind of collaboration we have with any kind of job providers. We won't have people who are skilled and trained to do so.
You seeing how much progress, if any, are you seeing just on that last front with the Kansas City, Missouri public school system?
I think that there has been some improvement, obviously, since we experienced the turnover of the system to the state.
Yeah.
I think there has been some improvement. What we face is something that is historical within our community in terms of it, and that is the high turnover of leadership. You were mentioning to me off air, 8 pastors in 150 years. It brings a sense of stability to an institution and an organization. One of the things that we struggle with, I believe, in our school system is the high turnover of leadership. When you have a leader at the top that turns over so often, it's hard to find that kind of congruency and a continuation of vision and mission and purpose and energy and momentum that's necessary in a place. So hopefully we can get those leadership problems
solved. With Dr. Stephen Green, I get the sense that maybe we've turned that corner now.
This is my hope and prayer as well.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888. Let's go to Joe from Kansas City, Missouri. Joe, good morning.
Good morning. I just want to say this is a great show, and I want to thank Reverend Howard. I've been knowing him for a long time, and he and I love history, and he is doing some of the things at that church, the miracle on 39th Street, to bring about and fulfill some of the dreams of many people in Kansas City. Thank you.
You bet, Joe. Thank you. And, you know, a minute ago, Reverend, you were talking about wages being paid to folks. Recently, we had a march in this town of fast food workers demanding more money. Were you involved in that? And is that the kind of thing, the kind of movement you're talking about here?
I was involved in one of the gatherings that took place at the Metropolitan a Baptist church where Dr. Wallace Hartsfield II is the senior pastor, and C.T. Vivian, a great civil rights leader,
Absolutely.
Was in town speaking and so forth. That event was sponsored by CCO. And for those that might not know, CCO is an acronym for creating opportunities and so forth for people. It is that kind of agitation and advocacy of the system that is sometimes necessary to wake the powers that be up a little bit to the hurt and the pain. I believe that there is a compassionate heart, that there is a sensitivity in every individual and person that's made by God. And sometimes when we dramatize and agitate and demonstrate the pain and the needs of people, then we have better chances, I think, of opening eyes to the possibilities of new vision and new opportunities for everybody.
Yeah.
If we can get a glimpse of the truth that our Constitution really is true and it really is filled with so much wisdom, we hold these truths to be evident. That all people are created equal with unalienable rights among these life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But not everyone is able to pursue that happiness on equal footing with equal ground. And so we've got to make sure everybody has that kind of equal opportunity. What you witness with CCO, I think, is one way to do it. Yes, absolutely. One of the things we're looking at on August 28th in doing is we are going to hold a commemorative march commemorating the March on Washington.
There's a bunch of churches involved here. It begins at Second Baptist Church, which is located 3620 East 39th Street. This is at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on the 28th, right?
That is correct. 4 o'clock p.m. we will gather at Second Baptist Church. We will hold a spiritual assembly from 4 to 5 o'clock, citywide assembly. And then at 5 o'clock, we will march from the Second Baptist Church of Kansas City to the Spirit of Freedom Fountain at 47th and Cleveland. And there we will be moving forth with a rally to commemorate the event that took place where Dr. King gave the I Have a Dream speech in 1963. There are various church groups, faith community groups that will be there. One of the speakers will be Dr. Wallace Hartsfield Sr., who's retired now, but who will be present to bring words, as well as a young vanguard of ministers and voices and persons in the community. One of the things we have to come to grips with is that sometimes it becomes necessary to pass on the baton and allow another vanguard and generation of leaders to carry it forward. And so we'll see that as well on that.
You know, we're talking about investment in the inner city, those kinds of things. And again, I should point out we're visiting with Reverend Dr. Vernon Howard, pastor of the Second Baptist Church, about the plight of his church. It's one of the two oldest black churches in Kansas City. You know, talking about investment in the inner city, Congressman Cleaver, one of your mentors, in fact, has made a big splash with something called the Green Impact Zone. You know, millions of dollars being spent on curbs, sidewalks, insulating homes, all of those basic kinds of things. I think your church is in that zone, I believe.
We are actually just outside. We are adjacent to it.
Is that kind of project, what impact does that have on the spirits and the people that you're working with every day?
I think that's an opportunity where Congressman Cleaver is working from the inside to have a great impact on the communities and neighborhoods that he represents. And it has a two-pronged effect in my mind. Number one, it does bring economic opportunity. Number two, it's good for the environment as well. And number three, what it does is gives a sense of hope and lets us know that a collaboration is possible between the higher levels of government and the local municipalities and neighborhoods and communities. One of the things we have to be careful for, again, is to make sure that we have people who are able to benefit from the kinds of work that is required to be done.
Yeah.
If our school district has not trained our people in computer technology and management and construction and whatever you have that is involved in that kind of work, then again, we'll be left out. It may help us from an infrastructure standpoint, but from real jobs and employment that are involved in getting the work done in the green zone, if we're not trained, we're left out again.
Now, you're a Kansas City kid.
I am.
You know, I was wondering, you were raised in a home without a dad. How did that work out for you?
Depends on who you talk to.
If you have an opinion out there, 816-235-2888. Yeah.
Absolutely. Born at KU Med Center, Steve, brought home to 45th and Cypress, moved to 3315 Indiana, which is a hop and a skip around the corner from this great historic church. The Lord has blessed me to be able to pastor.
Mm-hmm.
Walked up and down the streets of Paseo and Armour, Linwood, Benton, oftentimes me, my mother, and our siblings, with no father, no dad, mom, a single parent, working to put us through. I had aunts and uncles that were faithful helpers, guiders, and advisors. So it was extended family
mm-hmm.
that helped to get me through. It was a mother who remained faithful and was both mom and dad in the midst of the kinds of things that a young kid in the 70s and 80s goes through. Remember, we're talking about in the late 70s, 80s, we begin to see an influx of crack cocaine, an influx of Uzis and drugs, and the whole gang epidemic begin to explode.
And you saw much of that with your own eyes.
I saw it with my own eyes, and especially those folks that were 2, 3, 4, 5 years right behind me that got the brunt of it, and having survived that, and the way that it happened. It wasn't me. It was a connect between faith and education. I stand here by the grace of God, thinking not very highly of myself at all, but wherever I am, it was because of a nexus between faith and education, the development of my relationship with God, and the development of my mind to learn and think and grow and to understand. And I keep returning back to this education piece because it's so very important in the development of our kids.
And did I read this right? Were you once Roman Catholic, or did you just attend Catholic schools?
I attended Catholic schools and was actually an altar boy. And to this day, don't tell the St. Joseph Diocese leaders, but I did not wait for them to ask me or invite me. I just went back and started putting the altar boy clothing on and the garb, and I was there to help the priest, and he didn't know one way or the other. So I invited myself into being. I was an unofficial one, but I thought I did a decent job anyway.
And that's how you avoided the pitfalls of all that stuff.
I really do believe, Steve, that this nexus in a school environment with a child that's 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old.
Yeah.
In that environment of both faith and education, the development of the spirit and the soul, the development of the mind and the intellect at a very early age makes such a difference. And it's a difference maker.
And then you wound up going to college at William Jewell, of all places. Not a lot of black students up there. Why did you go there, and what kind of experience was that for you?
Leaving East High School on the east side of town around 20th and Van Brunt, I had a desire to go to William Jewell and wanted to study communications and wanted to do what you do so eloquently, Steve. I wanted to be in broadcasting. And it was close. They had a basketball program.
I need a co-host.
I played for you. We'll do some recruiting for you.
Yeah.
And play point guard and wanted to study communications at William Jewell. It was a school of great quality. I knew of its standard, and it's just something, an aspiration that I had. When I went there, I would need a basketball scholarship and was told I wasn't good enough. And so I had to select another school. So I went to another school for 2 years in Winfield, Kansas, then came back to William Jewell.
Scored enough points and get some attention,
yes, scored enough points and got some attention and was able to get the scholarship and wound up graduating there. And faced some difficult challenges at William Jewell, which is an outstanding institution. But as you say, of about 1,400 to 1,600 students, about 30 of us were African Americans, which brings on its own set of challenges and difficulties. But navigated through there and graduated from William Jewell.
You know, you served at St. Stephen Baptist Church here in town. Then you went to Arizona for a couple of years, Reverend. When you came back, you served at St. James United Methodist Church. That, of course, is the church that Congressman Cleaver has served for so many years. Why the switch of denominations, and what kind of mentor was Reverend Cleaver for you during those years?
The need at St. James at that time was for someone to come in who had pastoral experience, which I had. I think him having known me and my ministry was a positive as well. I think it was somebody who knew that he could trust.
Mm-hmm.
I also believe that when you look at the mission of the church, that denominational affiliation is less important than ministerial vision
mm-hmm.
and mission and relationship and purpose
yeah.
and the need to touch lives.
Yeah.
And so I didn't hesitate one bit. I was a licensed and ordained Baptist and did not hesitate one bit to come back and be a part of a United Methodist Church at all, because it was a part of my mission.
I think I just asked you a really big question, didn't give you enough time to answer.
That's
it.
That's all right.
But I really enjoyed having you today, Reverend. What a pleasure to have you, and what a insightful conversation this has been. What a great way to spend some time.
Steve, thank you, and it's a pleasure.
Hope you'll come back and visit again.
Anytime I'm asked.
You commemorate the March on Washington again on the
28th of August,
4 o'clock.
4 o'clock p.m. at SBC.
Okay, and that again is at 3620 East 39th Street. Okay. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Well, everyone's got an opinion on what the media is doing right and what it's doing wrong. Monday on the show, the media critics come back to examine the highs and lows of recent news coverage. We had help this week from KCUR's Kim Noble, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Sangeeta Shastri. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.